Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How are you tonight?
Fantastic. My voice is coming back.
Finally getting over that crud, huh?
Finally, it feels better to be able to speak without so much work.
Yeah, no kidding. It's going around. I saw something the other day that said that we are just entering into like the beginning stages and this one's going to stick around for a while.
Well, in that regard, I guess I'm lucky because I've done my I don't think you can get the same episode a second time, so I've put it behind me.
Very good. Tonight, we are going to be talking about who represents the victims. There are organizations such as NARSOL and SOSIN and WAR that are fighting for those of us on the registry. And then there is, in the contrast, there are the organizations that fight for the victims. And I thought that we should cover why are we out there trying to fight for, why we're advocating for for our people, the registrants, versus the trying to be a victim's advocate also. But first, we do have some news items that we can go over. And from the Press Herald, sparked by reports to Augusta police, a proposal to bar sex offenders from photographing children faces an uphill climb, but it raises issues worth discussing. The effectiveness of public offender registries, for instance, is highly questionable, with studies showing little impact on sex crimes and recidivism. So this article is talking about some legislation in Augusta, and I'm trying to remember where, but preventing sex offenders from taking photos of minors. And they're saying that it would have some challenges, and I think some of the issues would be related around should there be laws against taking pictures of children that are in public places? And how would you even go about policing this in the first place? And I wanted to hear what your thoughts would be on the subject of trying to restrict how people may or may not be able to take pictures of things in public places.
I'm not familiar with the story, but we've got Augusta, Georgia, and Augusta, Maine comes to mind. This
Yeah.
sounds more like something that would come from Augusta, Georgia, rather than Augusta, Maine. But who knows? But trying to have prohibitions photographing minors in a public place, it would seem like it would potentially run afoul of just off the top of my head. There's nothing unlawful about possessing a picture of a minor, even for a person on the registry. And it says the article, the link says their faces. So it would be, first of all, you'd have to figure out how to identify the sex offenders in the park, and then you would have to figure out how diligently to watch them, know how they've that they've actually broken this law to take a picture, and then you'd have to confiscate the photo, and then you would have to show that. I'm assuming that the first person that got charged would challenge this. I'm hoping they would anyway, because as we've talked on previous episodes, if this were to be able to be enacted in either a state or a city or a county ordinance, city ordinance or a state statutory scheme, it would enjoy the presumption of constitutionality until a challenging party steps forward and said, "No, it isn't. I object to this because I don't believe you can do this." But I can imagine that there would be relatives that you could justifiably photograph. And we've got long-standing doctrine that when you're in public, you have no expectation of privacy. So as a general rule, unless we reverse all the jurisprudence heretofore, anybody who is out in public is subjecting themselves to being videoed or photographed, and that's just a long-standing precedent. So they would have to overcome all of that to have such a prohibition. So it's not to say that we couldn't have an enactment placed on the books, but I don't think it would have a long shelf life if it were to be challenged, because there would be a lot to overcome for the state to prevail on enacting such a prohibition.
And what would even be the harm of someone taking a picture? It's almost assuming that having a picture is almost like being in possession of the person, and that someone is going to do behind closed doors, presumably, if you have a photo, that you're going to do something that would be, what's the word, lewd and lascivious with a photo. And how does that impact the person that has had the picture taken?
Well, this is so bizarre, but I would imagine they would put forth a theory that this would be a stalking type behavior, because anybody who's out taking a picture in a park of a minor, they would have ill intention. So the proponents of this would argue that you would be up to no good just by the facto that you're taking the photograph. And so that would give you information to help you identify the child later. And then they would say that the mere possession of the child would lead to fantasy of an unhealthy nature, and that could cause an escalation. Those would be the type of theories that they would put forward as justification. And they would get some expert to come in and testify, some so-called expert to come into the legislative body and testify that they've treated sex and that they do look at photographs, they do attach themselves to property of a victim, and then they do escalate from there. So I don't think they'd have any trouble putting on a convincing argument, because the legislators want to protect children, because that's what everybody else wants. So if this is put forth as a proposal to keep children safe, people would want to be receptive. It would be the rarest of legislators who would say, well, gee, this kind of makes no sense. And we're getting into some constitutional areas here. The reaction would be they would look for a way to want to justify doing this. And those who had any hesitation would be reluctant to speak out, because it's going to be soundbited against them in the campaign in the next cycle that they expressed reservations to protecting children. And their opponent would take two or three or four words and they would say, House Bill so-and-so, number 44, proposed to protect children from predators, and they would use the term predators because anybody on the registry is frequently referred to as a sexual predator. And Senator Sutchins expressed hesitation. If you elect me, I will protect children, protect victims, and try to prevent there be more victimizations of a sexual nature. So it would be a tough thing to oppose from a political perspective.
Isn't there some point where people would say enough is enough on any? I mean, can't you present that argument against anything practically and go, well, we will just move this to this next step and this next step, and moving the goalposts down the line until we are spending every possible penny to protect everybody from everything?
That's a logical argument. But in this particular area, I have not seen much pushback across the country on ever escalating requirements. The advocates' laws will never run out of things to advocate for, because if they did, that would mean the end of their advocacy. If the Center for Missing and Exploiting Children was to actually say, well, you know, we do actually find a dozen or a couple of children a year that have been abducted by strangers, but most of what we do is track down people who've run away from home from abusive situations, and they've been abducted by non-custodial parents who don't have permission to be in possession of those children. And once we track them down, we find out that they were in the hands of another parent or they ran away. But you think the donations to that organization would increase or decrease if they were to actually say that? So the only way they can justify their existence is to put forth the image that they're doing something. So they run their spots saying how many thousands of children that they've have located. They don't tell you that most of them that they located were never abducted by a stranger. That changes the storyline too much.
Right. The FBI statistics say, you know, 50,000 children are abducted and 49,990 of them are returned or found.
And 100 or so each year are abducted by total strangers.
Right.
And the whole nation of 330 million, it's amazingly small.
So they have to continue to feed themselves to stay alive.
That is correct. Not many organizations in the advocacy business, whether they're on our side or the other side. On our side, I wish we could go broke. I wish the day would come when we weren't needed. But on the other side, they don't want to go broke. It's like DWI. If you were to, we're getting off the topic a little bit, but if you look at DWI, through the last 25 years, DWI has been dramatically reduced by public education, by strict enforcement, a combination of things, raising the age for drinking. We've got a lot fewer DWIs. Well, the advocates, they don't say, well, hallelujah, we've made major headway. They say, well, we need to further lower the blood alcohol content, because it used to be 0.10. They went to 0.08. And now the net is not pulling enough people because there's fewer people driving drunk. So now, amazingly, they're advocating for a lower blood alcohol content so they can continue to fish in as many people. The system needs to be fed.
And no one's ever going to close up shop, go, hey, we've won, we're done.
I can't recollect anybody. The only thing I can recollect that closed up shop and said we're done was the Resolution Trust Corporation. It was created back in the late 80s, around 89, 90, to clean up the savings and loan debacle of all the failed savings and loans. They actually liquidated the assets and closed up shop. But most anything, whether it be government or whether it be a nonprofit advocate, they seldom close down and pronounce success. So,
all right, then. All right. So the next article comes from the Review Journal. A Las Vegas man killed over dislike of sex offenders. Report says a Las Vegas man told his neighbor he killed two homeless people behind a Central Valley swap meet because one of them was a sex offender, court documents show. The neighbor explained he had been sexually assaulted as a child and took offense to sex offenders, 32-year-old Michael Thompson's arrest report says. So here's a guy that, when he was a child, was somehow assaulted sexually as a child, and goes to the neighborhood swap meet, and behind the building or whatever, there are two people, and they are two homeless people, and he decides to kill both of them. And in reading the article, he killed the woman because she wouldn't leave, but he killed the guy because he was a registered sex offender. And the guy was convicted in 1984. So what is that, 33 years ago, 34 years ago?
So this is a new one on me, and I feel embarrassed that I didn't catch this, but it's certainly not the first instance where we've had a person on the registry targeted for merely being on the registry for violence and death. And seldom do they make the proclamation they're killing the person because they're a sex offender. Usually the harm just mysteriously happens, and the law enforcement says we can't establish any direct link, so therefore we don't think being on the registry had anything to do with it. So if they were to say as oftentimes as it probably did have something to do with it, it would undermine the justification for the public registry, because if people knew how many people were being victimized because of being on that shaming. But this is tragic. So two people, this is similar to the South Carolina case 4 or 5 years ago where the couple were targeted, the wife and the husband, because he was on the registry. And at that time, Nikki Haley was the governor, and Narsil called on her to suppress the home address information of the registrants because of the violence in her state. And of course, she ignored us. But this is tragic.
Yes. So, like I said, the person was convicted in 84. And from a conceptual point of view, can a person ever live beyond something that they did in their past? That's I'm not sure if I can word that much better. But I realize that we are the sum total of the decisions that we've made through our lives. But does that mean for any past mistakes, we can never get beyond it?
Well, it certainly is. That's more and more of a problem in America, particularly if you're on the sex offender list, but even for non-sex offenses, because of the easy dissemination and accumulation of criminal histories and records that have been purchased or obtained for free or being resold and redisseminated. It's almost impossible to live past. But this is so tragic because it was only a few years ago that Nevada's registry was largely not in public hands. It was a level where only level threes were listed to the public, and then they changed their law. And there's been several unsuccessful challenges. So everybody is now on the website. So it might have been a few years ago, this guy may have been a level one and not even been visible because of the age of his offense. And then when the law changed, all of a sudden people know that he has this history that wouldn't have known it prior to the change of the law. So this is a serious tragedy. And the defense lawyer, of course, will say that he was a victim and he snapped, and that he shouldn't be held accountable or certainly shouldn't be punished as much because he had PTSD because of his own victimization, and this will be a defense. And of course, if I was on the defense team, that's one of the things I would argue. You do what you can to minimize the damage to your client, but it's a tragic outcome.
And why don't we have a vigilante justice system?
Why don't we have a vigilante?
It's a total tongue-in-cheek kind of question. I mean, yeah. This is totally vigilante justice.
So, well, in my mind, vigilante justice should be met with very swift and very, very stern response, because we would have a complete breakdown of law and order. The reason why we have a justice system is because we don't want people administering their own punishment. There'd be a lot of heads chopped off, and a lot of things would be different. So society has come together in an orderly fashion and created a system where it's supposed to be some relationship between the crime and the punishment, and the victim, who is really just a witness in the crime, is supposed to have a role, but not the role. I think the role has grown beyond what a proper role for a victim is. And I think we're going to touch on that later, but the victims cannot take the matter into their own hands. Maybe he was a victim, he wasn't, but he had no right to do what he did.
He was a victim in a different case. So here he is, going out defending somebody else in this, I mean, if 1984, the guy could have, I don't want to minimize any of these crimes because they're all bad, but he could have had an inappropriate relationship with a minor that, he was 18 and she was 14, whatever the laws would have been deemed to get him on the registry at the time. He could have done something that was almost like Roy Moore, for example, and that put him on the registry. And now he's dead for that reason.
So tragedy. I'm going to read more about this after this podcast.
Minnesota sex offenders challenge a city's ban. This one comes from the Star Tribune. And criminal justice researchers have found that geographic-based residency restrictions are largely ineffective at preventing crimes, in part because offenders tend to victimize people they know rather than pursue strangers living in close proximity to them. And here in this particular article, I'm reading that sex offenders in Michigan have, or sorry, Minnesota have a 2,000-foot restriction, and that this has been declared unconstitutional. Or excuse me, that they're challenging that it's unconstitutional. And we have covered that topic in, I think it was in episode one where we were, I don't think we've covered residency restrictions. We've probably touched on it around the sides, but I don't think we've actually covered it directly.
So I don't believe I recall an episode where we've directly addressed residency restrictions.
But the men are challenging a far-reaching 2016 ordinance that forbids convicted sex offenders from living within 2,000 feet of any school, daycare, park, playground, bus stop, even a pumpkin patch or apple orchard within the city of Dayton, a rural community of about 5,000 people northwest of the Twin Cities. So I guess, can we briefly touch, I think that we could probably do a whole episode on residency and work restrictions, but just to touch on it, do you happen to know maybe like how many states have residency restrictions and work restrictions?
I don't, because like this article is referring to a municipal ordinance that's in, okay, in Dayton. It's not talking about the state. So what we have across the country is we have a hodgepodge of restrictions. We have restrictions that are imposed by supervising authorities while the person's paying their debt to society. And then once they cease, and they've paid their debt to society, they cease being subject to those requirements. There are cities, county, and states that impose restrictions on where some or all people in the registry can live. Some of them, like in Arkansas, for example, they restrict where a level 3 and 4 can live. And then in Arkansas, they have a risk-based system. So theoretically, that person has had some due process to be assigned that level. So that residency restriction, that statewide residency restriction, and Arkansas has been upheld in the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the 8th Circuit, because it provides adequate due process protections. But these blanket restrictions, like what you probably have there in Dayton, where everyone on the registry is subject to this, those are a lot more problematic, because what these communities end up doing is they end up creating a total exclusion, or an almost near exclusion zone, for their whole city. There was a case out of Lewisville, Texas that was challenged, where Lewisville had managed, through their residency restrictions, through their ordinance, they had managed to exclude about 99.4% of all the parcels from being available for registrants. And I may have the number wrong. It may be 97.5, but anyway, it was way up in the 90% of all parcels in that city from being available. And a federal constitutional challenge was brought against the city of Lewisville, and unfortunately, it did not fare very well in the courts in Texas. The district judge at the trial level was not impressed. The Fifth Circuit of a Court of Appeals, which is where that state falls within the Fifth Circuit, which goes to New Orleans, they were not impressed. So Lewisville gets to keep their ordinance. So what's so tragic about it is because you have competing dueling requirements of the cities wanting to outdo one of the other. They're trying to, the offenders out, they're trying to tougher than the next town. So if one has 1,000 feet, the next one wants to have 1,500 feet, and they want to make sure that they drive the offender somewhere. And without a court ruling that says that the state has preemption and they have supervisory control for uniformity, or without a state statute, which my state has, we've prohibited cities and counties from doing this very thing. You have just tragic consequences where people can't go back to where they were from before they got in trouble. They can't leave one city and go to the other. If they find some place on the right side of the railroad tracks they can live, they're kind of pushed to the industrial zones and to places that are not very desirable. And then they come along, when you asked earlier about what do politicians, when they run out of ways to be creative, then they come back and they'll have an advocate come in and say, well, these sex offenders are clustering. And they're only clustering because you made little pockets of places where they can live. And then they'll pass a law saying that a particular complex can only rent X percent of its apartments Or maybe they'll only can be one person on the registry at a particular address. So they will never run out of creative things to do. So the only way we'll stop this creativity is through successful legal challenges or electing people who will push back. And that's hard because the people, the general population, support this kind of stuff. They believe that they're safer if they have these rules that an offender can't live within 2,500 feet of them. They think that somehow makes them safer. No evidence to support it, but they believe it.
And I can see where they're going, like in theory, like the concept sounds right. But then when you do push them out of your town, they have to go to the next town. But then the next town does it. And how long until you actually end up at a constitutional challenge that says these people can't live anywhere? And they're almost like Tom Hanks in the movie The Terminal, where they have nowhere to go and they're just stuck inside of a box.
We've got that very situation where they're living in tents and woods and under bridges, and we've got that situation across the country.
As long as it's not in my backyard, it's okay.
So if we ask ourselves, are people dangerous as we think they are, or are we safer with a nomadic lifestyle? Or are we safer if they have a fixed address where they can be periodic checks and there can be observation and there'd be less anonymity? I tend to think that if the things are as people believe they are, that we're safer as a society if the people have a fixed location to live.
Wouldn't this be sort of related to gerrymandering, like packing and cracking?
How so?
Well, if you've made exclusion zones, you've essentially packed them all into one area. And in the other direction, if you make it so that, you know, only one registrant can be at an address, it would be like cracking and distributing them about.
I guess in a sense, you could make that claim. I know that if I were in property management, I was a subject to, if I had 300 apartments and the statute was telling me that I could not rent to more than two people that were in a particular population, I would object and I would probably initiate a cause of action. I don't need the government telling me who I can rent to. And most people would say that they don't need the big old bad government interfering in private business.
Yeah, if the person is able to pay their rent every month and they keep a decent property about them, then what do you care what their situation is?
But I'm making a broader point. I bet of our thousands of listeners, they tend to lean on the conservative side. Most people wouldn't want the government interfering with relationships that businesses choose to engage in. So who is the government to tell a property manager that has 500 units or 300 units or whatever that they can only rent two of them or one of them to a person on a particular list? What entitles the government to do that? Isn't that doing the exact opposite of what people who claim they're conservatives and try to keep government out of people's lives? Isn't that doing just the opposite? If you're interfering with the ability for them to have a relationship of with someone they choose to have a relationship with?
I think you make a good point.
Well, it's interesting because oftentimes we find that conservative side. I know in my right now, there's a lot of people who are clamoring for more state support for parks. And we're told all through our lives that something is supported with tax dollars, like alternative fuels or whatever it may be, that we don't need to be pumping tax dollars into such crazy scams, that it'll somehow, when it's cost efficient, it'll sell. But then magically, when it comes to this, the private market isn't able to provide enough care professionals for people with Parkinson's. And the people who are clamoring that normally object to government intervention, they're clamoring for government to pour a whole bunch of money into Parkinson's to get more treatment providers and get more services for Parkinson's. And I'm a supporter of those kinds of things, but I'm a progressive. And I don't understand how a conservative who doesn't like taxes can, on the one hand, say, let's pump a bunch more government money into this type of service and then not tell us where the money's going to come from and decry taxation all in the same breath. I'm just confused about a lot of this stuff.
People talking out of both sides of their mouth.
So I'm confused about how the government can interfere with private business. I think that would go contrary to everything a conservative would stand for.
This article comes from the Tallahassee Democrat. Felons' rights proposal goes on November ballot. The Voting Restoration Amendment, which was approved Tuesday to appear on the ballot as Amendment 4, would automatically restore voting rights to felons who have served their sentences, completed parole or probation, and paid restitution. Murderers and sex offenders need not apply. So why would we exclude anybody from, if you're going to put that through, you've already isolated out convicted felons to some degree, and then you're going to give it back, but you're going to say, oh, wait, not these people. Why single out murderers and sex offenders?
Do you want me to give you a political answer?
I would like you to give me both sides.
Well, what's happening here is that Florida is one of those few states where they don't believe in restoring voters' rights. There's a list out there of restoration disenfranchised, and my state does not disenfranchise after people pay their debt. There's a few states that actually, while you're paying, you're not disenfranchised. Up in New England, there's Vermont, and I think another state where you can continue to vote while you're in prison. I don't know the mechanics of how they actually perfect that delivery of the ballot, how that's done, but it's who believe that once you've made this mistake of a felony, you should never get it back. So what's probably taking place in Florida is that their support to restore voting rights automatically to people, but the proposal would die with this for people. So the question becomes, from a political perspective, do we want to continue to have the status quo where no one can vote after they've had a felony conviction, or do we want to lift the prohibition on as many people as can and come back and have this discussion another day after all life as we know it doesn't end from having a total ban on felon restoration? So
would this be one of those cases? It's a subject that I want to bring up with you on. I still don't know how to title it, but writing bills that will get passed to help some instead of having the whole thing squashed.
Well, that would be an example of that, in one form of what we would be talking about. There's probably a lot more port restoring voter rights for those who've been convicted of crimes, but the average person is just like the average convict in prison. The hierarchy on the inside behind the walls is they're good criminals and they're bad criminals. Now, it tends to work just the opposite in most regards, except the sex offenders on the prison hierarchy also are trash, just like they're on the outside. But in the prison hierarchy, murderers are pretty high on the totem pole as far as recognition and honor. But in that system on the outside, you've got the same thing. There are people who feel that people who have made less heinous mistakes deserve a second chance. So if all you've done is embezzled from your employer, or all you've done is breaking and entering, or stole the old lady's Social Security check and things like that, those criminals are not nearly as bad as people have done sexual assaults and killed somebody. So you can get broad public support for giving certain types of criminals a second chance. But they see this as these people made too great a mistake. We just can't forgive them. Of course, it's interesting in a southern state where the Bible is taught so much, and there's all this religious perspective about forgiveness. It's interesting, if you look at the South, they're much less forgiving and much more punitive, where the Bible is the strongest. I've never been able to quite compute that in my head, where the Bible is strong as punishment, and the lack of forgiving seems to go hand in hand.
You got me on that one. But I do understand your point, though, and it is a subject to go into more detail about writing a bill. I'm just stuck on how to like come up even with like a title for it, of almost like writing a bill from an offensive posture to give the other side enough that they'll support it while not throwing all of your people under the bus.
I'll look at it more from a posture when I employ that strategy. It's if something is bound to pass that I don't like, but I have counted the votes and the opinion so overwhelming. So on an issue like real ID, that was controversial in my state, but we had to do something because the public clamor had been driven to such a high level of high fevered pitch that there was going to be a real ID act. So the question you have to decide when something is going to pass, do you want the people who would do the most harm writing the bill and making the law, or do you want to participate to try to neuter some of the bad parts and try to get it their version? And you just take your marbles and go home and say, I'm going to fight to the bitter end, and I'm going to try to kill this, and just you lose and it passes their version? Or would you like to work with them and try to come up with a version that'll do less damage than what they had originally proposed?
I think you make a lot of sense.
All the time, because people tell me that I'm a quitter, that I should never give up the fight. Your system.
Wow.
Work out something that you can be still dissatisfied with, but you can take off the worst parts of it. So I use this strategy more in a defensive posture, but you can use it in an offensive posture, because if you want to get something passed, sometimes it's incumbent upon you to do something uncomfortable that you don't like. For example, the border wall. Not many progressive Democrats are in favor of building a wall and expending that money, but they're very much in favor of providing relief for the people who are on the deferred action deportation list. And so the president has leverage.
Right.
He says, I get my wall, or the deferred action against childhood arrivals is what DACA stands for. I'm going to lift the embargo, and we're going to go deportation. So that's the parliamentary system. So I have to decide, if I were in office, do I want to protect the people against deportation, or do I want to stand steadfast against the wall? And in all likelihood, you're going to have to compromise, and you're going to have to swallow something on the wall that you don't like, but you'll get a lot of criticism. There'll be a lot of people who say we should never wall off this border. But I'm a little more pragmatic. We may have to give the president some money for his wall.
Right. Even though it's really not what the issue is, but that's a different conversation too.
It makes people feel good to know that there's a wall. it's one of those things where if you were to study the problem, you would probably find out that there will be, I can't imagine we could ever build a fortress wall that would be 2,000 miles long that we could keep everybody out, because they tunnel under walls and they do all kinds of things, and they fly balloons over. But there's enough creativity that people are still going to get in through bribes and you name it. So I don't adhere to the strategy of if you can't stop everybody, you shouldn't stop anybody. But I'm just convinced if the United States is a prosperous country, people want to be here, they're going to find a way to get here illegally. And I'm not sure the wall is going to be a significant barrier. We're already apprehending a significant number of people that try. I mean, it's not as if the border is wide open and there's a flood constantly coming across the border. You know, that's a misnomer. We have a pretty successful apprehension program already.
Right, right. And then second to last article from MassLive.com from Massachusetts. Westfield officials hesitant to repeal sex offender ordinance despite high court ruling. Why is everyone so concerned with the assailant's right? He asked. We need to find another outlet so these level twos and threes can't live in certain areas. When they do something like that, they throw their life away. And this, I think, ties into a conversation we were just having a little while ago about the residency restriction kind of things. But so the individual says that when you commit one of these kinds of crimes, you essentially throw your life away. And so, again, I think I asked earlier about, can you ever overcome your history to the point that you can reintegrate into society? This one troubles me as well.
Well, for a person to say that you throw your life away from one mistake, I have problems with that. I even have problems with people who commit murder. I mean, that's supposedly the ultimate crime, but we've actually learned through the years that murderers, the lowest recidivism rate of all crime?
My understanding is sex offenders.
So if you threw your life away because you killed somebody, there was a time in the state of Georgia you could be paroled on a life sentence after 7 years. I think it's either 25 or 30 now.
I think it's
30.
But
there was a time where people got out after seven. Yeah, it's dramatically gone up. So in my childhood, as I was growing up, after I became an adult, a boy that I had gone to school with got in a passionate, what is that called, a crime of passion, when he found someone with his woman,
right.
and he killed the guy.
Right.
And he got life in Georgia, and he served 7 years. They paroled him. He's never been in any trouble. He's been successful. But so it's unfortunate that someone would say that you throw your life away by committing a crime. I guess he says, when they do something like that, they throw their life away. It's the quote. I don't know what all the like that includes, but it's unfortunate that people out there.
Some statistics about Westfield. It's a population of 41,500 people. There are 15 level three sex offenders. And then there are 4 level three offenders that work in Westfield. So they're trying to make this ordinance to deal with 18 people.
Is an affluent community, because this sounds like something that people have money have decided that they want to do to push these people out of town.
I would be willing to bet that this is exactly what this is. This is a Wikipedia Westfield. What's their demographic?
Well, there's a lot of affluence up in Mass in general, but if this is a particular affluent place, they just don't need those kind of people around there.
Of course not. You wouldn't want them. Now, what would be, I don't know if Wikipedia is going to give me their median income or anything like that. Screw it. We'll go on.
You'd probably find that in something like the quick facts from the Census Bureau. There's a Census Bureau, and you can put in a state and then a city or a county, and you can get quick facts about the demographics, the racial makeup, the economic.
Median income is 61.
And how does that compare against the state of Mass?
Median income.
I know that's way above. That's way above our median.
I think the median income for the United States. Wow, the median household income is $75,000.
Well, then
in Massachusetts.
That theory shot down.
Wow,
so, yeah, it's not a particularly affluent place. So the pressure is coming from somewhere else.
That's crazy. That's high, because I think the median income in the United States is a good 20 grand below that. The median income, well, the median income for the U.S. is 57.
So, and we're way below that in my state.
Right.
We're 49th.
Yeah. Wow. You're 49th out of 50 in median income?
I'm pretty sure we're 49th in most everything. We're right on the hills of Mississippi for being 49th and all the bad lists.
Our final article is from The Atlantic, where Nassar's judge went wrong. By endorsing vengeance from the bench, the judge sentencing the disgraced Olympic doctor crossed an important line. And what did she say, Larry?
Oh, God. She said something to the effect that if there wasn't a prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, that she would advocate that what was done by Dr. Nassar to be done to him, which would be sexual assault. That was a very tragic series of comments that was made. I can't imagine that a person who's bound by the canons of judicial conduct would endorse vigilantism from the bench. I can't imagine that. It was shocking. So,
and this crosses a bunch of lines, though, politically from you regarding that a judge is supposed to be impartial and just deal with what the facts are and throw the sentence down. That's kind of the end of the relationship, maybe?
Well, there is an expectation of impartiality, and judges are human, so they're going to have emotions, and they're going to be moved by things that they hear. I mean, that would be impossible to expect unless we go to the Stein model of having robots do the sentencing. So we're gonna have emotions, but part of what you get paid the big bucks for is to conceal those emotions and not spew them out from the bench. And you take a recess if you're feeling a particular emotion that you can't contain, and you come back after you've contained yourself. But it certainly did not come across. I didn't hear her say those. I just read the quotes that were in The Atlantic and another publication of what she was quoted to have said. But that is certainly not an impartial person who says that she would, but for the Constitution prohibition, that she would advocate for that.
I have it right here. If the Constitution didn't forbid cruel and unusual punishment, she said, she might allow what he did to all of those beautiful souls, those young women in their childhood. I would allow someone or many people to do to him what he did to others.
So, well, that's pretty close to what I think I recall reading. So, you can have those emotions. A judge is, they're going to have emotions about what they feel about this individual. But that's where her power ends. Her power is to impose a sentence of punishment prescribed by law and not advocate anything. His punishment in Michigan, they don't have the death penalty. I think they haven't had a death penalty since the 1860s.
Jeez.
So that's not an option on the table. So her option to say that I'm sentencing you to a very significant amount of incarceration to make sure that there's no threat posed to you and to the public. I don't think that would be over the top.
Right.
But there are people in prison that will know about Nassar, and they will feel that it's their job to take care of business, and that society doesn't have the right structure. And he will be in grave danger when he goes in prison. And there will be some listening to this will say that's fine. But if we have a system where vigilantism is endorsed by a judge, that just can't be good for anyone serving a period of incarceration, because our job as a society, when people have their freedom taken away, their ability to protect themselves greatly restricted, we're supposed to provide a safe environment for that punishment. We're not supposed to encourage vigilantism. We don't want a Jeffrey Dahmer situation. If anybody remembers, Jeffrey Dahmer was the guy that lured several young men, I think 10, somewhere between 10 and 20, into his home and killed them. And they were guys. So the last one that he got away with was a person who was fleeing him and seeking help from the police. And the police thought, since the guy was obviously a flaming homosexual, that they didn't get involved in it. And he ultimately got possession of the young man again and killed him. And then he got killed in prison. Yeah, we should not wish that on Dr. Nassar or anyone.
It, again, in another conversation, it's a slippery slope. So if this is the crime that crosses the line where there's some level of vigilante justice, when does it move into the next category of crime of, I don't know, battery, you know, a guy beating up his girlfriend or whatever? When does it move into that category and on down the line until, if you jaywalk, you end up getting your ass beat?
Well, that's the whole point, is that when we promote and encourage vigilantism, there would be an escalating cascading effect of vigilantism, and we would not want to live in that type of society. This is not healthy for us as a nation of laws to have vigilante justice.
Got it. All right, moving along. We did get a comment from, what actually it said John Doe, and he or she wishes to remain anonymous, but as best as I can tell, the person was from Illinois. And he says, hello, Andy and Larry. I want to thank you both for these podcasts. I've listened to each one, some of a few times. I hope you're getting good numbers. It's okay to get off topic. Ha ha ha. I would buy you guys both lunch just to hear you two go back and forth. Sorry for no return email. My state's internet usage laws are scary. And I did just as cursory a lookup that I could to find that he was from Illinois. And so he has a prohibition on internet usage, or to some degree, he has some sort of prohibition on internet usage. But thank you very much for the comment. It's greatly appreciated.
So, and we welcome your comment. If any of you want to write to us, you can do so at registrymatters@gmail.com or visit our website, registrymatters.co. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Or use the most inefficient ever devised. You can reach us by calling 747-227-4477.
And moving along, so from our last episode, episode 8, we talked about the probable cause hearing before retaking, and we received this comment from Charles. I can relate to this problem because I was on probation from Florida, serving it in Maryland. I was accused of technical violations. Maryland wanted to send me back to Florida. I had heard of this requirement in the Interstate Compact and asked my attorney. He'd never heard of a probable cause hearing and told me to waive extradition. I finally did get my hearing, but I had to hire a different attorney who reached out to NARSOL for help. Thankfully, we did get a hearing after I pressed the matter. So that's great that someone could relate to the podcast that we did on it. And anybody out there that you may know that has transferred to another state, maybe send them a link to that episode 8 and so they can be aware of it in case they run into some sort of snag in them being in the other state.
Well, I believe actually I was the resource on that particular case, if it's what I think it was. And that is something where I would be delighted to help in this predicament. Many of our people, if they're in this predicament, they may be incarcerated. But if they happen to be in the free world, there again, they can reach us through these means of contacting. And I'd be happy to talk to anybody. And the voicemail number, again, is 747-227-4477.
Excellent. And we did get a voicemail message from Chris, and here we go.
I'm on probation and live in a northern county in Georgia with severe restrictions. Early curfew is just one of them. I was sentenced nearly 10 years ago with a similar crime commit date. My paperwork states that I have only one restriction, and that is no contact with a victim. I can be around children with no problem. Even my PO has said as much. I'm waiting to buy a house and live with my girlfriend and her children. They're saying that there's a new state policy, and this is his policy. The offender shall not reside with any child under the age of 18, including his or her own children, unless proved in advance and in writing by the court, quote unquote, that my PO learned of in late of last year. My question is, now, do I need to go and hire an attorney and go to court, or do I have any other recourse in this matter? Any explanation or answers that you may have in this matter would greatly appreciate. Thank you, guys. Bye.
So I thought that you'd be a great resource to answer Chris's question. If they can change his probation restrictions that weren't addressed in his sentencing.
Yes.
All right, moving on.
This is an answer I give all the time, and then it requires a little explanation. They can do things until they're told that they can't. And the authority that tells them they can't is a court, or in some cases, policy. So that message alludes to a state policy or some sort of policy. I think he said state policy.
Yeah.
That says that a person can't reside with minors without approval of the court. So what appears to be happening, I'd like to talk to him further, but what appears to be happening is the probation entity has decided it wants to shield itself from making any decisions. So they're going to force the decision-making and the discretionary call to be made by a court. So they're telling this guy that our policy, you can't do this, you can get a judge's permission. So the downfall of that is that many individuals don't have the money. So say they were represented by a public defender, court-appointed, however the Georgia system works, he's in a county in North Georgia, and I think they have a combination of both. Of a some larger counties have public defender systems and smaller counties still appoint private members of the bar. But one way or the other, what happens if you have public representation, they can't represent him necessarily any further because he doesn't have a criminal action pending against him. This is a quasi criminal matter because he's not facing a revocation, so there's nothing to defend against. He would only be facing a revocation if he violates the policy,
right,
of living with the minors without permission of the court. So he has to, they're telling him, you're going to have something to court to get the court to give you permission. So he's in a conundrum because if he doesn't do it, he risks violation. And I can't think of anyone administratively he can reach out to because the administrative agency has already indicated by the policy that they would like to duck the decision. So they're going to force him, knowing that many people are limited and how easy it is for them to get to court. That diminishes the likely thing happening because a lot of people won't have that door open to them. So if this gentleman, much to my chagrin, I would say if he has the wherewithal financially, he should file that motion court. And my suggestion would be that he cite to the fact that it says it's a general policy, that there's no individualized, that the department is not expressing any individualized concern about him. They're just having a blanket policy about no contact, no living with a person, no contact, or whatever that policy says. And you would attack the policy from its perspective that it's overly broad. And then if the judge wants to make an individualized determination and not just take a swat at the policy saying, hey, this policy, you need to at least determine if this policy should be applied to him. The judge could say it should be applied to him, or the judge could say this is a ridiculous policy. The judge would probably tell us why this should apply to let probation state a reason why that they should apply that policy to him. But I don't know of any way around he can do anything without going to court. He's got to either go to court or he's got to risk a violation.
Right. Mm. Is there anything else like this, Larry, where it's if you don't, God, how do I mean, if a fisherman goes out and he goes against some sort of quota ban, or I don't mean ban, but just a quota, and they bring in more fish, do they go to, is that criminal?
Well, it can be.
Okay, so you fish 10 pounds over whatever some quota, I forgive me, I'm completely ignorant on it, but you go over your quota, you come back in, they measure it, and you have been deemed to have exceeded your threshold, so they literally cuff you and take you to jail and try you for overfishing.
Well, the cuffing is a rarity as far as I understand about game and fish violations. They're normally accompanied by citation, but citations can be both criminal and civil. You can get a civil citation where the only option is a fine, or you can get a criminal citation where there's an option of both a fine and incarceration, which is seldomly imposed on these type of things. It's seldom that a person gets a criminal, but when you get a traffic citation, you go to criminal court.
True.
When you're standing in traffic court, you're in a criminal court. If a police officer's giving you a ticket, you're in a criminal court.
Yeah, I get. Okay, I'm just trying to, I'm trying to make a comparison in this situation where Chris is just trying to live his life and who he has chosen to love, even if that is a choice. So he's got a girlfriend and she happens to have a couple kids. So they moved in together. And that is then in violation of something that changed. Okay, let's go back to let's see if this works. Could you be tried for overfishing for something you did 10 years ago? You overfished 10 years ago, even though it wasn't illegal at the time. And now they state that it is. They go look at your records. They find that you overfished, so they bring you to court.
Well, and generally speaking, no, you couldn't be, because that would be an ex post facto law.
Right. Is that, have I painted a semi-realistic analogy?
Well, you have. That's always the question when a person has been sentenced for a crime. There is some discretion given to supervising authorities to fashion reasonable conditions that they can articulate for that individual. But see, what they're not doing that here. He said in his message that it was a policy.
Right. It's a blanket statement.
So there's where it begins to break down, in my opinion, because they're not making an individualized assessment. They're just saying we don't let anybody live with minors. And apparently, I guess it's anybody under sex offender supervision. That he wasn't clear on. But so you are in effect prohibiting him from having a relationship of his choice, which was a punishment that was not imposed on him for that crime. And it's not being done with specificity of any concerns articulated about him. they can only make one general assertion that these type of conditions are designed to protect the community, which is another component of it. The probation supervision is supposed to involve the deprivation of more liberty, no more liberty than reasonably necessary on the offender, from the offender, to protect the community, promote the rehabilitative intent of probation. And this blanket policy, you can't say that it's been narrowly tailored if it's applied to everybody. So I think you're in the right ballpark, but he has to litigate this.
Right.
We're back to the part where everything revolves around they can do it until they're told they can't.
Right.
And there's only two entities that can tell them. That's the people who made the policy or the courts. And unfortunately, in America, everything related to the courts costs money.
Yeah.
Generally speaking. And I was on this tangent a couple of days ago. A guy was on a conference call, and he said, I wanted to get post-conviction relief. And he said, I talked to a dozen attorneys or whatever he said, and not a soul would take my case. I said, your statement you just made is not accurate. I said, that is an untrue statement. And he said, I couldn't get nobody to take my case. I said, but you're omitting one key part that you should tell. You couldn't get anyone to take your case pro bono. I said, that was what you were after. He said, yes, I didn't have any money. I said, well, of course you didn't have any. You were in prison. But the legal profession is the only profession that I can think of where there's an expectation that people provide their professional services without compensation. You would never go to the mechanic shop and have them diagnose your car and say, well, provide this service to me pro bono. You would never call the furnace repairman and be upset that he didn't come repair your furnace pro bono. A furnace is a pretty important thing. Do you agree? When you're living in Michigan in the middle of the wintertime?
Definitely if you're cold.
Yes, but we never get down on people in our capitalist system except attorneys who also like to pay their bills, send their kids to school, and draw a salary. And then, as I said earlier about the dichotomy, we don't like to pay taxes to support these entities. So public defense costs money. And somebody, I mean, I don't think we have a right as society to extract the service without compensation. They merely because you have a law license, we will come and we will deprive you of your livelihood because that's your duty. We don't do that to anybody else. We don't tell the furnace man, you've got to go repair their old lady's furnace because it's one of your duties for holding a license, a mechanical one. So I find it kind of interesting that, yes, I'm sympathetic to the fact that people have less access to legal service than they should, even though we have the Gideon decision and we have this mantra that we provide services for people. We provide the minimum we can possibly get away with in most instances, and it's seldom adequate.
Right.
We have a lot of good attorneys in the public defense system suffering in crushingly high caseloads,
right,
with very, very inadequate investigative and resources for investigative purposes and expertise that they need to hire to combat the state's limitless resources that they can put up against you in the way forensics experts from their crime labs. The defense side is severely limited that. And when you go to the general public and say, we would like to have more resources to pay for indigent defense, you just don't get a lot of applause when you make those arguments. That's just not something that John Q. Citizen understands.
Well,
so
all right.
I wish I could help Chris more with this, but I'm afraid it's going to revolve around him going to court, and he's going to probably have to pay for this one. Being poor he is, I'll be surprised if he can get this done through any system that's provided at no cost in North Georgia.
Right. We've talked about that offline, a number of, you know, some sort of vehicle to bring something into court. And this is just the thing that you either have to test them to see if they're going to kind of push back against you, or you protect yourself up front and try and get the judge to let you do it. So it's an extreme case of it's not better to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission. In this case, it's better to ask for permission than to ask for forgiveness.
I would say so. I would not encourage if he's received that policy, I would certainly encourage him to follow it until a court has relieved him of that policy. Otherwise, he would risk being hauled in on a violation.
Right, right. All right, so on to our topic for the night is about protecting victims. And you have people that commit heinous offenses. The victim may have to go through psychological treatment for years or even decades. Maybe they're not even alive. Who's out there protecting them? And then why are we doing any advocacy work for people who have done wrong?
Well, I'll take the second part first in terms of why we're advocating for people. Our system is an adversarial system, and it's designed that way. That's why we have a prosecution defense, and that's why we have the neutrality of the judge. And so there has to be an advocate for the people who have been accused. So, well, the prosecution is the advocate for the victim. But not only is the prosecution, most prosecution offices, most district offices are equipped with victims' advocates as a part of their staffing. So when you look at the directory of most DA's offices, you'll find the victim advocate branch. So you have within the system, you have the prosecutor who is seeking punishment and justice for the victim. Then you have the victim's advocate who's advocating in court on behalf of the victim, and they're advocating keeping the victim informed through the process, telling them what their rights are. So you have that component, and then you have various organizations who advocate for victims' rights. And so you already have a significant, robust effort for those who've been victimized by those who've misbehaved. And you can't throw in the towel and just have people assume that the system that's designed to be an adversarial system will somehow protect those who've been accused of crimes. Yes, people have been accused of doing things that are wrong, but without any advocacy whatsoever, what would stop the court from maxing out everybody who's sentenced? Because without an advocate, how would the court know what the facts in favor of leniency and mitigation? How would the court know that without an advocate for the accused? How would the court know if the accused had been charged with a statute that was more appropriate for not or more appropriate or less appropriate, did not really fit that particular offense? They were charged with the wrong offense or too many counts. Without an advocate, how would the court, the neutral referee, know that? The neutral referee can't get involved in finding all those facts out and advocating because the referee's neutral. So who would do that? There's only one side that can do that, and that's the defense attorney. And so groups like ours, few and far between, like the ACLU and NARSL, we try to remind people that this is an adversarial process. It's based on fairness and justice, and having a one-sided process where one side gets to decide everything and that there's no rules that apply to them and that the accused has no rights, that's no system of justice. So that's where we're coming from. The victims have many advocates. The accused only has one, and that's the attorney.
And the victim has kind of the whole system, the whole legal system in their corner to begin with.
That is correct. In criminal justice, the system is more and more designed for the victims. There's victims' bill of rights in these states. Victims have an enormous amount of rights. And people, if they could have an intellectually honest conversation, if the victim were going to have total say-so, there would be no need for a justice system. There would be no need for a referee. The victim would just extract their vengeance.
Oh, you mean like going to behind the flea market and killing people?
Yes. The reason why we have this organized system is because some victims want more punishment than is appropriate for what that person did. And they have to be told, no, we can't do that. That's not appropriate for what happened here. And it's becoming more and more difficult to tell a victim you're asking too much. And that's very unpopular to say that. No, you don't get to put this person away for 5 years because they stole $100 from your grocery store. That's not a fair trade-off. You need to be made whole. You need to get your investment back. They weren't entitled to take your property. Also, asking the unreasonable, we don't need to spend $150,000 for 5 years of incarceration as a society and ruin a person's life where they'll be a drain on society for the rest of their life because you feel so strongly that what they did justifies a horrendous punishment. That's not a decision you get to make as a victim. We get to make that as collectively a society what the appropriate punishment is for misbehavior. And that's what we do through our laws. And that's what the justice system is supposed to reflect, is those collective decisions we've made after thoughtful deliberation about what the proper punishment is for misbehavior. It's not for the victim to decide.
They are part of the process, but they are the initiation of the process, but they aren't. They're almost a innocent. They're almost a third party to it. At that point, then you're just dealing with the facts of the case and then exercising the punishment against the perpetrator.
They are, to be more precise, they are witnesses in a crime headed against them. The people make the rules about what's unacceptable behavior. You don't get to make your own rules. So you may find something objectionable the person does, criminal. We collectively convene in our various state capitals, in our U.S. capitals, and we decide what is criminality and what the punishment is. So your opinion about something is not that relevant.
That's
because
okay.
it may be society decides, for example, with drug, there are a lot of people who believe that drugs are horrendously bad and we should never legalize anything.
Right.
But in the states where they've legalized the recreational use of marijuana, if you find that distasteful, that's not for you to go burn up their growing, whatever you call it, where they farm. That's not for you to do that. That's your personal opinion. Society has decided collectively that they're entitled to do that, and you have to butt out.
But marijuana is a gateway to harder drugs, so we need to shut it all down.
But you made that argument and you lost. Those are where the states have, they've decided to legalize that. You had your place at the table and you lost the debate. Well, the same thing happens in criminal behavior. You may think as a victim that the person should get 20 years. But if we've decided that that crime carries a maximum of 5 years, you don't get to make that decision. They get the penalty that's appropriate, that the people have decided, because the people made the rule that was broken. It's a violation. That's why the actions are styled in many states people versus such and such.
Okay.
Because it's a crime again.
And the people put the people writing the laws how?
By electing to represent them.
So we the people went to the polls and we elected John Q. Public to be our representative for our district or our Senate seat, whatever. And then they go to the state capitol or the DC capitol, and they then craft the bills that then the governor or president sign into law to be exercised.
That is correct. And the penalties have been ratcheted up severely in the last 20, 25 years. But that is a direct reflection of the people. I don't agree with all those ratcheted, but that's my personal opinion. I've lost that debate because the majority of the people have said, we want harsher punishment. We want longer sentences available. We want three strikes laws.
But our votes don't matter. They don't count.
Why is that?
I hear people often say that the politicians were already predetermined, so your vote doesn't matter.
Well, I can't imagine that anybody really believes that their vote doesn't matter, because elections are won. Matter of fact, if you just look at the outcome of a race in Virginia that was too close to call, that determined the control of the House of Representatives. I think they call it the House of Commons or whatever they call their lower chamber in the
yes,
House.
Yes.
That race was very much determined by the people, and they had to use an extraordinary measure because of the tie. Do you remember that race?
It was just a month ago. Yes. Yeah, they totally pulled a number out of a hat or a name out of a hat.
Yeah. So if one more person was so disenfranchised and thought that they didn't have a say, so if they had voted in that district, the outcome would have been different.
Right.
So of course your vote matters. Now, when you have a country of 330 million people that has a relatively archaic electoral process like we have in America that was designed a long time ago, obviously who voted greater than the occupant of the Oval Office, they do feel disenfranchised because their vote didn't matter.
Right.
But that is still our system. Our system was designed and we haven't changed it. We have the capacity to change that system anytime we want to go through the process of amending our Constitution.
And every, you know, and I don't want to go
it's
on
a
this tangent.
Process, two, it's been done, what, 27 times?
Yes. And every state then has their own electoral process in that arena also. It's not a federally mandated process of how they elect their people.
That is correct.
Well,
unless they get into issues of suppression of minority votes and voting rights, which several states are under challenge for doing that. Pennsylvania most recently had their state Supreme Court declared their congressional districts to be gerrymandered and designed with racial suppression.
There's some crazy looking districts, man. There's some crazy looking districts in Pennsylvania. It is very funny. You could one politician could drive across his district and run into his counterpart multiple times in the process, because it like loops around. It almost like there's almost like enclaves set up in some of the districts where one wraps around the other one entirely.
Absolutely. That's gerrymandering at its finest.
It's the best. That's all I got, Larry.
Well, I am so glad to be with you again. Look forward to getting more.
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it, and have a great night.
Thanks, Andy.
Bye. Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Or you can leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 9. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.